business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040681, Kristen Turk-Belt and others versus Oppenheimer, Glenn, Harrison, and Tate and others from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Justice Green is not sitting in that case. And docket number 040607, consolidated with 040608, In re the John G. and Marie Stella Kennedy Memorial Foundation and In re Frost National Bank and others. Justice O'Neill will not be sitting in that case. In both of these cases, Justice Johnson is participating but was not able to be present for argument this morning. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between each argument. The proceedings are being recorded. A link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in number 040681, Kristen Turk-Belt and others versus Oppenheimer, Glenn, Harrison, and Tate and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Barry Snell will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Chief Justice Jefferson, members of the board. May it please the court. The issue in this case is whether the court will extend the immunity the court has previously granted in the case of Barcelo versus Elliott to attorneys engaged in estate planning against suits by beneficiaries. The question is whether the court will extend that rule so as also to bar suits by the client's executrix. If so, if the rule is so extended, it will mean that lawyers who do estate planning work will never have to answer to anyone. They will have complete immunity because the only persons that can sue when estate planning goes awry are the client who is not deceased, the beneficiaries who are barred under Barcelo, and the executrix, which is the question before the court today.
But none of this, and we're just dealing with the pleadings, right? In this case?
That's correct, yes.
We have no evidence at all.
No, sir. Strictly a summary judgment on the pleadings, Your Honor.
Yeah, so with respect to the pleadings, what is there about the complaints that the decedent couldn't have known about if in your view, he had better legal representation?
Well, Your Honor, for example, the decedent may well not have been aware that he could avoid a lot of taxes on the $6 million in cash and cash equivalents that he had in his estate as he approached his death.
But did that not come to light until after his death, or could, in your view, a better lawyer have told him about that before he died?
Oh, yes, sir. Of course a better lawyer could have told him. Also, some of the transactions that were undertaken, Justice Heck, failed before the IRS because they weren't properly documented, proper appraisals hadn't been done, things hadn't been done that caused attempted estate planning not to pass muster with the Revenue Service.
I know we're only dealing with the pleadings, but is there anything pleaded that first and only came to light after his death?
All of the matters complained of only came to light after his death, Your Honor. He, unless he were a very astute estate planner himself and wouldn't have needed a lawyer, he couldn't and wouldn't have known that the transactions, for example, that were undertaken were not sufficiently documented to pass muster with the IRS.
But in your view, a better lawyer would have known that before he died?
Yes, Your Honor. Would have done it right in the first place. Right. It wouldn't have been a question of knowing if these problems wouldn't have existed.
Do you claim the injury occurs at the time the estate is structured and it's just not discoverable until after death?
Yes, Your Honor, that is what we claim. The court's question addresses what's known as the legal injury rule, where if the estate planning attorney, as we allege, fell short in his services, a legal injury occurred right then during the decedent's lifetime. At a minimum, the decedent could have sued to get his money back or pay the cost of correcting the defective estate plan, having another lawyer go through and fix the things that were wrong.
Well, and I think this follows up on Justice Heck's question. Do you claim the nature of the injury here then is inherently undiscoverable and the discovery rule has to apply?
I do claim that, Your Honor. However, the court's the question of discovery rule really pertains to limitations,
exactly.
When a cause of action accrues for purposes of limitations. When a cause of action accrues, though, for other purposes other than limitation, are governed by different criteria. The discovery rule really doesn't have anything to do when a cause of action accrues for purposes other than limitations. And I would direct the court to a discussion in Swift versus State Farm, 129 Federal 3rd, 792. It's a Fifth Circuit case, 1997, applying Texas law, which incidentally has a good discussion of Texas law as to the accrual of causes of action on legal malpractice. But it points out that a cause of action can accrue for ownership purposes before the statute of limitation begins to run. And the court says the discovery is relevant to a determination of when the statute of limitations begins to run, but that is not an element necessary for a cause of action to accrue for purposes other than statute of limitation analysis. The rule that governs when a cause of action accrues for other matters is the legal injury rule, and this court's opinion in Apex Towing versus Tolan, 41 Southwest 3rd, page 118, says a cause of action accrues when facts have come into existence that authorize a claimant to seek judicial recovery. It's clear that a client who pays for estate planning services and doesn't get that service, or at least it's not well done, as soon as the lawyer completes the work in a defective manner, the injury has occurred, and at least the client would have the right to seek judicial relief for the cost of fixing it or recovery of the fee that was paid. So,
what the survival statute allows personal representatives to bring the lawsuit for injuries incurred by the decedent during the decedent's lifetime. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct.
So what are the injuries that are that occurred here as a result of the faulty estate advice?
Well, the of course there would be a legal injury that occurred in that he paid for estate planning services that he didn't get. I think the real injury, though, occurred at that moment in his life when he reached the point of no longer being able to correct his will or change his will or correct his estate plan.
Most of that's at the moment of death, right?
Well, yes, sir, if he were conscious up to and competent up to the very moment
of death. No, I mean, if he sets up a trust an hour before he dies, then he doesn't get taxed, and if he doesn't set it up, then he gets the taxes in effect imposed at the moment of death, isn't it?
Yes, sir. The taxes are determined as of the moment of death. But when he lapses into his final unconsciousness with a defective estate plan in place, I think the harm is clearly done then.
Well, I mean, but even there, technically, one lapsed into unconsciousness a year before death, guardian might be appointed, all might be done by the guardian. So really, until death, he's not harmed.
I don't know, Judge. Can a guardian write a will? I wouldn't have thought so, but perhaps.
Do
perhaps
almost anything with court approval.
I honestly, that's beyond my expertise to tell you that.
It's not usual, I'd agree.
But yes, I suppose technically there's no question that estate taxes arise based on what your estate has in it and what form it takes at the time of your death. I do acknowledge that. But the legal injury, under any analysis of legal injury, has already occurred because the client could bring a cause of action. He could seek judicial redress.
Help me figure out how this is going to work. Personal representatives of the estate are almost always beneficiaries in Texas. I mean, that's a fact. People, I mean, yes, the super wealthy appoint banks, but everybody else appoints kids.
No, that's it's often
spouses or kids. So they're usually going to be the beneficiaries too. And the main thing we're talking about avoiding taxes is that I during my life have to give up control of the property so I don't get taxed on it. If I have control of it, generally speaking, I'm going to get taxed on it, right?
There's greater or lesser extents of control that can be retained.
So basically, these cases you're wanting to bring, and they say are can't ever be brought, no way, no how. Your case is going to be people who are beneficiaries saying, Daddy would have left us all this money earlier and given it up. And they're going to be saying, that's not what Daddy told us. And so we're going to be, how are we going to prove that one way or the other?
Well, Your Honor, that's a proof issue like any other case with disputed facts. It may be a difficult proof issue. In this case, we'll have evidence that they've admitted they didn't discuss certain estate planning techniques with the decedent. And he certainly did everything they did say. I mean, he did a lot of estate planning and made a lot of transfers to partnerships on the advice of the law firm.
But the question will be, even though his estate plan expresses no intent to give up control, we believe privately he had such an estate plan.
Yes, sir. That will be a fact question. It will be a proof question. And in many cases, it will be a difficult and maybe even an insurmountable one. But the fact that a case is hard to prove.
Make estate planning more or less expensive?
Judge, I don't honestly think it would affect estate planning. I think the cost of it, I think it would make lawyers...
Of course you do. Let's assume people who are liable for things charge more money than if they're not liable for things. That's pretty easy, right?
Yes, sir.
And if their rule is right, basically your argument that you started off with, they can't be sued for anything by anybody, so estate planning will be cheap.
Perhaps so, Your Honor, and we can make insurance a lot less costly if we don't let people that are hurt in auto accidents sue.
We close all the courts, insurance will be cheaper.
Yes, sir, we can. We can make manufacturing cheaper if manufacturers were not responsible for defective products. There's a lot we could do if the economy were the sole criteria.
In Marcello, we were worried that it would be better to have a bright line rule than try to sort through this.
Yes, sir.
And perhaps you know the O'Donnell case.
Yes, I do.
And it's here, too.
Yes, sir.
And I haven't looked at the record in the case, but from the Court of Appeals opinion, it looks like the services were rendered about 30 years before the decedent's death, and that there may have been a problem of characterization of the decedent's predeceased wife's property as separate of community.
Separate,
it would have gone through her heirs, and if it had been community, he would have got a bigger share. So it just looks from reading the opinion that the decedent might have had a reason in his own mind to want to characterize the property as community rather than separate, even though 30 years later the complaint is more of it should have been characterized as separate. Is that not an example of a case that would be very hard to sort through 30 years later when the taxes they are more than people think they should be?
It sounds hard to me, Justice Heck. It really does. It sounds like we'll present difficult proof problems, but it's not uncommon. We have in medical malpractice, for example, the issue of causation and science behind cause and effect is often extremely difficult to prove, and difficulty in making proof has not usually been a grounds for denying litigants access to courts to try to remedy a wrong. Some cases will be very easy to prove. Others may be insurmountably difficult to prove. But we've never let that stand as a barrier, at least traditionally we don't, to allowing litigants their day in court to seek justice when they've been wrong.
What are statutes of limitations about then?
Yes, there are statutes of limitations, Your Honor. Of course, there's generally in the field of legal malpractice, as the court knows, the discovery rule is applicable, generally speaking, to malpractice type claims, and it is often the nature, I think, of malpractice in estate planning that it is inherently undiscoverable because it is it's a highly technical, complex field. It doesn't necessarily follow common sense at all, as far as I can determine. It takes someone highly trained and skilled to detect the malpractice in many cases.
We've discussed this morning whether the decedent has suffered an injury. Do you say that the estate suffered any injury, and if so, in what regard?
Yes, Your Honor, the estate's paid $1.5 million in taxes that could have been avoided with competent estate planning.
And have we recognized an estate's injury in that respect before? For legal malpractice, I suppose.
Not that I've been able to discover.
The exception to Barcello.
No, sir. I mean, not in the context of estate planning. Now, in other contexts, I think so. If a lawyer had negligently failed to file an answer and a default judgment were taken against an innocent person, that person died. I don't think there'd be any question. I don't think Mr. Canaan would tell you that that person's estate couldn't seek redress. But I don't know that you've encountered that before in the area of legal malpractice in the form of estate planning.
I was thinking of Cornyn's dissent, which was perhaps dicta, well, not dicta, but a comment that the estate suffers no harm from a negligently drafted testamentary document.
I actually think, Your Honor, that was in Justice Spector's dissent. By the way, in Barcello, Justice Spector said in that dissent that the testator's personal representative would succeed to the testator's cause of action upon the testator's death. She made that statement, and no one took issue with it. Of course, I understand it's dicta, and it's only in a dissent, so I certainly don't maintain that it's absolutely controlling, but it seemed to be the mindset that, of course, the testator would sue. The problem there is that I think Justice Spector was talking about, if there's only a disappointed beneficiary, if Aunt Sally doesn't get the thing she thought she was going to get, the estate itself is not diminished. It just goes to the residuary or other beneficiary. So the testator has a difficult cause of action because the estate is not reduced. Here, though, the testator is trying to preserve the estate itself. And I think this is an important distinction from Barcello. Here, the testator and all the beneficiaries, and all the beneficiaries are presumably aligned. They have the common goal of having the estate pie being as large as possible rather than competing beneficiaries struggling over the size of their particular piece of pie,
not always. Some people actually leave their estate to the government for reasons I can't imagine, but some people do it. And you could decide to do it this way.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not out of the question.
It would be hard to understand why you would be spending a lot of money on estate planners, though, whose job is to reduce taxes, if that were your objective, to just leave it to the government. There are a lot of policy considerations, though, that are going by the wayside that Justice Cornyn recognized in his dissent in Barcello, which, by the way, was only a 5-3 decision. I think that everyone would agree there are policy reasons that are well recognized. We don't usually want innocent parties to have to bear the financial burden of someone else's mistakes. We generally agree that holding people accountable for their neglect improves the behavior and tends to discourage negligent behavior.
Thank you, Mr. Snell. Are there any further questions?
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I forgot the red light.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal. The court is now ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Martin Hanan will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning, may it please the court. On behalf of the respondent, clearly the Fourth Court of Appeals felt that the court's decision in Barcello was controlling of the facts and circumstances in this case, and that the effect and force of that precedent compelled the decision there, and I think it compels the result still today. This court has had the opportunity in the past to discuss the importance of precedents. I've referred to the court's case in Weiner versus Wesson discussing medical malpractice limitations for minors. There, the court was asked to overturn a precedent of some 12.
Well, but we wouldn't have to overturn. We would just distinguish. There, I mean, you'd agree that when you have beneficiaries competing for the pie, it's very different than having an executor or executrix bring a suit on behalf of the decedent.
I would not agree that is different, Your Honor. That the practical impact and the interests asserted are identical whether it be the personal representative or it be the beneficiaries in person.
Well, except that what they're trying to do, I see that they could overlap if you had maybe a beneficiary who was also an executor, but the beneficiaries are all trying to get their different pieces of the pie, whereas the executor is trying to maximize the value of the estate.
Well, to carry the pie analogy, the personal administrator is attempting to determine the extent of the pie, if you will, which will determine then how many pieces can be divided up among the beneficiaries. Clearly, the interests in terms vis-a-vis the estate planning considerations of the underlying defendants, the lawyers, are no different, and the policy considerations which were emphasized in Barcelo.
Well, let's say you have a bank executor, and the bank has no interest in who gets what. They just want to maximize the assets. What would be wrong with allowing that executor to sue if there's no conflict of interest?
Well, the conflict of interest arises on behalf of the estate planner at the time of the estate planning. Irrespective of who's going to be asserting the interest of the estate, if the interest of the beneficiaries or the interest of the personal representative are to maximize the estate, and in this case what we're talking about are tax consequences, then the lawyer, the estate planner at the time of the estate planning, his consideration is the interest of the decedent, or at that time, of course, his client, the testator, without any consideration of any potential claims, whether those potential claims be brought by the beneficiaries or by a representative of the state, or the interests of the beneficiaries or the representative of the state. At the time of the estate planning, and this was certainly a primary reason expressed in Barcelo for the bright line privity rule, that if the estate planner at that time had to take into consideration the interests of potential claimants, and I suppose that would encompass both personal representatives or beneficiaries directly, if the estate planner had to take into consideration those contingencies and those potential claims, then his dedication and loyalty to the client would be conflicted.
But your position,
and it wouldn't matter who the potential claimant
is. But your position would result in no malpractice for estate planners, ever.
At least in the circumstances presented in this case,
well,
or in Barcelo.
In what circumstances would there ever be? Who could ever bring one?
Before the court is not the question of a totally invalid will, for example, that would be created by an estate planner. We have here a valid will that expresses the intent of the testator on its face, no invalidity, that to challenge that is to start exploring what may have been the intent of the testator irrespective of a valid will expressing that intent. Before the court, for example, would not be a case of an estate planner who created an entirely invalid will that could not benefit the intended beneficiary.
But it looks like from the pleadings that, and that's all we have, that what might be being claimed is that the decedent wanted to do something, everybody agrees that he did, and the lawyer messed it up.
I don't see that in the pleadings, Your Honor. I think that
failure to obtain appraisals of certain insurance policies before transferring, failure to obtain appraisals of certain ranches changed to no. I mean, is it possible, just from reading the pleadings, that that was on a checklist of things that should have been done to make this valid, and it wasn't done? I don't know whether that's true or not. But
the will itself, no one questions the validity of the will. The failure to take appraisals to transfer properties had to do with transfer properties into partnerships. There we get into the question of lifetime consequences of tax decisions. The emphasis by petitioners is that there are tax consequences after death, and this is harmful.
But
well could have been questions of control of the assets.
No, but I'm not saying that. I understand that. And maybe it's a good idea to have these limited partnerships, and maybe it isn't. But if once you've decided it is a good idea, and no one wants to contest that, but to get it done, there have to be these appraisals. That seems to me part of the burden of the pleading. And there weren't these appraisals. Then why isn't that just a classic malpractice claim?
The appraisals were part and parcel of transferring the properties to the limited partnerships and thus losing control of the properties. so that if one takes into consideration the judgments based upon lifetime consequences, i.e. control of the assets, then control of the assets would mandate that no appraisal be done, not a failure to appraise property that otherwise should have been appraised, but a failure to transfer property, maintain control of the property, and on the even on the pleadings, just no appraisal necessary. But again, to determine the issue that the court is suggesting, it goes back to presumably a swearing match as to what the intent of the testator was, irrespective of the documents that evidence that intent. And that is contrary to the law of the state, at least at this point, but more importantly, goes back to placing that estate planner into the conflict position of considering not just the lifetime consequences for the testator and presumably the intent of the testator, but how it might look based on the tax consequences for the estate itself, asserted whether it be through the beneficiaries or through the personal
representative. Mr. Kanaan, would your approach, that is, that once the testator dies, no cause of action can be brought for the estate planning legal services, would that provide a perverse incentive for normally upstanding professionals to try to hide any problems until the testator dies? Wouldn't that create an incentive that is inappropriate?
With all due respect, I think that casts a shadow on the estate planning bar that's not appropriate.
As I said, the bar's, I think, generally an upstanding set of professionals. And I'm not saying that, I haven't said that anyone is going to take advantage of it. I said it creates an incentive, doesn't it?
It does. But I think that is more than offset by the negative incentive on the other side, that if estate planners needed to be concerned about potential claims from unknown beneficiaries or personal representatives, that would be a negative incentive not to represent the client. And frankly, it would also mean a lack of control by the client of his counsel of choice, that a client would make a choice of counsel who then would be making determinations not necessarily for the benefit of the individual who selected him for estate planning purposes, but for the benefit of that client and unknown beneficiaries or personal representatives in the future. So I think that the incentive, whatever incentive there would be for bad folks to take advantage of the immunity, if that's what we want to describe it as, is more than offset by the necessary impact if the bright line purview rule were eliminated for personal representatives as well as for beneficiaries.
Of course, it would be easy enough to protect yourself against these claims. I mean, lots of estate planners videotape the will signing today to show that they warned the client. I understand you want to keep control of these and not put them into a trust. I mean, it'd take a moment's work to protect yourself completely.
And some would certainly do that.
So
the practice defensively.
So why should we make a harsh rule like nobody can sue estate planners when they can easily protect themselves?
I'm not sure everybody would have the ability or frankly, the forethought to protect themselves in the way that the court has described. I think certainly many would. And to the extent that would protect some folks, I suppose that's good. I'm not sure that would be complete protection in all cases if, in fact, a lawsuit on behalf of the beneficiaries or estate representatives were allowed. But certainly some people would necessarily do that. But the net impact, frankly, of what is being argued on behalf of the petitioners is to equate damages to the estate to tax consequences without any consideration at all of the lifetime consequences for the testator. And effectively, I think they're asking that the courts be allowed to rewrite wills. That effectively what would occur is that notwithstanding that the testator would have had the opportunity and taken advantage of whatever lifetime consequences he saw and get the advantage of those lifetime consequences, whether it be 1 hour before death or 30 years before death, and he took advantage of those lifetime consequences, that petitioners are asking that we change the will to to allow certain tax consequences that were not contemplated at that time, and that the attorney who was the estate planner bear the burden of those taxes.
But if that were such an overwhelming concern in cases like this, wouldn't our jurisprudence be more in the mainstream? I mean, Barcello is not in the mainstream of American jurisprudence in this area. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. It is a minority view that is correct.
And does any state hold that an executor can't bring this type of action as opposed to a beneficiary?
I have not seen that particular issue arise, Your Honor. It was mentioned in the Maryland case, which followed Bruce v. Noble, I guess, which followed Barcello by about a year. But it also said that that case would be limited to, if the executor brought the case, it would be limited to the cost of the legal services at the time, because that's the only cost of action that accrued for the estate through the deceased.
There was no privity problem.
For that particular limited recovery, which is not what the plaintiffs are seeking here when we talk about the tax consequences to the estate.
Thank you. Your Honor, to address Justice O'Neill's question, I would refer the court to McDonald versus Pettis, 988 Southwest 2nd 9, which is the Supreme Court of Arkansas in 1999. The court did hold the executor couldn't bring a legal malpractice claim, but that was based on a unique Arkansas statute. The court allowed the executor to bring other claims on behalf of the estate, saying that the estate becomes the decedent posthumously, that the executor is the estate for all intents and purposes, and did find the necessary privity with the attorney. It was only an Arkansas statute that we don't have that did not allow the executor to bring the legal malpractice claim.
If we agree with you in this case, don't we in effect set aside all our cases saying that beneficiaries can't challenge? Any beneficiary, even if a beneficiary is not a personal representative, they can ask the court to be appointed a personal representative or substituted in. And if that's so, then can't every beneficiary, by getting themselves appointed personal representative, end up doing the same thing we said beneficiaries can't do, which is suing, saying the testator wanted to give me all the property instead of my brother or sister?
Your Honor, first of all, I question the premise of your question. I think that the personal representative is typically named in the will.
Right, but that can be changed.
I suppose it would be possible that someone could replace the executrix named by the testator.
Sure, you file a claim of undue influence, and if the trial judge believes you, you replace them with you. And then, in effect, we're back where we were before all of this. Beneficiaries have a way around the system, and they can end up suing, saying, Daddy meant it to leave more to me and less to her, and estate planners are in a bit of a pickle then.
Well, Your Honor, I suppose you can come up with a hypothetical where that might happen. It seems awfully remote to me, and it couldn't happen in a case like this where the question is not the exclusion of a particular beneficiary who got cut out. It's a reduction in the size of the whole estate.
But nothing you're asking to do would avoid that. How would we draw a line that says your case but no others?
I wouldn't ask you to draw a line. This is my case but no others. But if it's some case that's a lot different than this, of course the court could rule differently on different facts. One point I would like to make, Your Honor, federal law allows bankruptcy trustees to sue on behalf of a bankrupt for a cause of action that accrued before the bankruptcy, including legal malpractice. And that doesn't seem to have done any great violence to the ability of attorneys to represent people prior to bankruptcy. I can find nothing. I don't see that as a public concern. I don't think it has done any harm at all. And I think it's very incongruous that we would let a bankruptcy trustee sue for the estate of the bankrupt, but we won't let an executor do
that. Well, but the concern is the debtor is still alive, and so you can put him on the stand and ask him, what did you tell the lawyer to do? What were the considerations? Here, it's quite common that somebody who is planning his estate will do so in ways that those who succeed him do not appreciate. He'll cut people out, take more control of property than they think he should have, And then going back and saying, well, you should have done it another way with the fellow in the ground is awfully difficult to sort out.
Again, is the fact that proof may be difficult grounds to eliminate the cause of action? I would suggest not. Another incongruity I'd like to mention, though, we do let the lawyer sue the deceased client's estate for his fee. And it just seems fundamentally unfair to let the lawyer sue for his fee, but not the client sue for malpractice. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Snell. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.